Because we only have a single mic to record audio with, the most pertinent questions were restated in studio without the member present. I have kept to the spirit of the question as asked in the interview.
Real life stories of real life men. These are the many voices of the Brothers in Blue Reentry Program. Real voices. This recording was made at the Lansing Correctional Facility, inside the maximum security prison. The aim of this recording is to provide you, the listener, with a real life glimpse of the men who make up BIBR. Who they were, who they are, and in some cases, who they hope to become. These men are in varied states of change. Some are beginning their journey of change, while others are still searching for direction. We hope to meet these men where they are, providing them the tools and resources they need to heal, to grow, and to develop into responsible men who value integrity, productivity, community, the very values that serves as a foundation of Brothers in Blue Reentry. We hope to impact change where change is needed most. None of the men interviewed gave their names, but chose to remain anonymous. The idea behind this was to encourage an openness, to establish a degree of vulnerability that only anonymity could bring about. Additionally, with anonymity, these men are less likely to speak for praise, saying all the right things to make themselves or the program appear other than what reality dictates. Instead, these are real voices, in all its flaws, imperfections, pain, strife, struggle, and despair. But there is hope as well. Everyone has a story to tell, how we come to be the person we are today. So perhaps something said will be relatable to you, or perhaps something said will grip you with horror and disbelief, whatever the case may be. Please listen without judgment or any preconceived notions of what the inmate, criminal, or prisoner is. Rather, listen for the sake of listening, for it has been said that once a person knows your story, the hows, the whys, and the what fors, it remains difficult for that person to continue to hate in ignorance. And also, in the sharing of our story, therein lies healing, acceptance, restoration. Only hurt people hurt others. In the telling of our stories, that hurt is spoken away, and thus, healed people seek to heal others. Thank you for listening to Real Voices. This recording took place during a Saturday afternoon in the cell house, where the majority of the inmates are members of the Brothers in Blue Reentry Program. However, the room in which the recording was held is near the general population cells. As such, the occasional background noises or voices you may hear are sounds coming from these inmates, a constant reminder of prison. While a penitentiary texture is less hoped for, it speaks to the reality of where the Brothers in Blue Reentry Program members reside. It also speaks to the courage these men have, seeking change in an environment traditionally hostile to reform. Myself, an inmate member of the program, I interviewed men one-on-one to record glimpses of their life stories, sharing with them the idea that people really want to know who they are, but, due to courtesy, are polite enough not to ask the questions most inmates are either too embarrassed, shamed, or embittered to talk about. Their past. Yet, here we are, sharing. Several men individually chose to participate. You will hear their stories, new stories from different men each week. The men you will be listening to run the gamut of the program. Men from all walks of life, some young, some much older, black, white, Hispanic. Some grew up in extreme poverty, while others came from military backgrounds or from middle-class families. A few men had no fathers in their young lives, whereas others knew their fathers, yet chose to rebel against them. The life complexities are endless when considering what you will be hearing from these men. Last, while the crimes committed are talked about, the details have been omitted. The most important aspect of this recording is not what was done, but the emotions and thoughts behind the crime, or what was going on in the life of that person. And the crimes vary. Obviously, not everyone in prison is incarcerated for the same things. But what seems most apparent of all is that most knew about Christ while living in their parents' or guardian's household, yet the strictures seemed too much to bear.
I grew up in the church. My grandma used to always make me go to church. Actually, it was a rule. If I stayed inside the house, I had to go to church. So growing up the whole time, church was just like a routine. So it made me rebel against church. I went to church so much, I didn't even want to go to church no more. I just said, I'm done with the church thing. And until I got locked up in 2010 was actually the time that I actually really want to commit my life to Christ. That's when I really said, okay, Lord, you're the only person I can turn to in this, because trying to do me and doing everything else I was doing just wasn't working out.
The paths of destruction are legion. However, drugs seem to be the choice many of the incarcerated chose to bury their pain or life issues with, which often leads to further isolation and criminality.
I was in drugs real heavy. I went to sleep. My drug of choice was ecstasy pills and cocaine and PCP, and I did that daily. And it started to have an effect. Sometimes I would steal from my mother's purse to get drugs, steal from my grandmother, and it started to have an effect on the relationships that we had, because I had jobs. I was a functioning addict. I just had to always have more of it, more. I had to just feed it. And it was getting out of control. And in my mind, I know that it's out of control, but I have this other side that just keeps pushing me to want to do it. It was real addictive, real addictive. And I remember when I was 16, I checked myself into a drug rehab. And I checked in for ecstasy pills, because I would go to sleep taking them and wake up taking them. So I wasn't eating. I was dropping weight rapidly, and it just got way out of control. Well, I did it for 30 days in the inpatient, actually stayed there. I was supposed to stay 42, wound up leaving. I don't even remember the reason why I left. I'm trying to justify that I only came here for the pills, and I'm off of them now. I've been off of them clean, longest ever been clean at that time. And for a while, I did good. Maybe 2 weeks, I didn't give in to anything. Then it started to progress. I start smoking weed, start drinking a little alcohol. That start really getting out of control. And then the next thing I know, I'm right back into what I just tried to stop.
True of most men sharing their stories, that first taste of drugs led to their seeking more extreme highs, while justifying in their minds that drugs made them somehow normal.
Smoked a cigarette, smoked the weed, and next thing you know, I'm always interested in trying something. I never got into the whole crack deal or the whole heroin deal, but in the meth. But I enjoyed the highs. But after a while, I didn't really start smoking weed until I was 18. Really start smoking myself, actually buying it. But pills and cocaine and PCP, which we call wet on the streets, I just got addicted to it for some reason, you know, just enjoying how I feel like, and it was a comfort zone for me. I can talk to anybody I want to talk to, made me want to move around, because I'm really shy. So this made me more open in my mindset. That's how I thought, honestly.
The circumstances in which their addiction played out rarely remained personal, but rather involved hurting, betraying, or lying to others. Some robbed, stole, or pushed away family or friends to pursue their high. What would they do?
First, going to steal my mother's purse, stealing her money. Sometimes I would even have my own money. That's what I do, okay. But I would justify it in some way. Pawning stuff. of value, you know, rings, Xbox 360s, you know, and here Xbox 360 might be 300 and I might just get 150 for it and not even having it for a month. So I'm not even enjoying the Xbox 360 just for a day's worth of high, you know, and just a whole bunch of compromising, burned a lot of bridges. To be truthfully honest, I had a friend and his mother had just got her income tax check. And it was probably almost $6,000. And I was high at the time. And I remember she left the money inside her drawer. And I knew the house real well. So I knew their back window stayed open. So I climbed in the back window and I took the money. Now they know, don't nobody else know their dogs. And still to this day, they don't know. But I knew I burnt their bridge. They knew I did it, but they couldn't prove I did it. And it's bad because she treated me like a son, you know. I went through dry seasons inside my life. My family's always been supportive, but when I start getting older, they wanted me to learn how to be a man too, you know, to support myself. And when I went through that little transaction, she little phase inside my life, she helped me out. She would feed me and everything. And
this is the lady you spoke
to. Yeah. Stole the money from. And as much as I want to call her, I know that it would even damage her even more if I tell her. So I just kind of not believing in God's hand or handle. But that's a bridge I wish I would never burn, you know, because I look back at that now like all she did was ever try to help me.
Have you sought forgiveness from her?
Well, I'm in here right now. I have to, don't nobody know where she stay at but me. And I don't know the exact address where she stays at, just know the street. And I want to, just to tell her, just give her closure, you know, just kind of man up, you know. That's where I'm at in my life, just to have peace in my own life. So, yeah.
Did anybody ever help you get off drugs?
Well, my father, he tried to force me to get off of them. Whooping after whooping after whooping, and lecture after lecture, and it didn't do nothing but make me want to rebel. Which everything he was saying was true, but I felt like at that time that I knew everything, that nothing could stop me, and I knew it all. And my auntie would always pray for me and tell me to come to church, and she would always warn me. She would always warn me, and I never took heed to it. And it all backfired on me eventually. You know, my life, I was a function addict to now I wasn't such a function addict. It was getting too out of control. I got on probation for it. I lost my job behind it because I wasn't able to work sometimes off what the night before, still high, not been asleep. So it had a major effect on my family because they didn't know me. You know, they didn't know me. They didn't know. They're here this whole time, they thought that I was this way, and to find out to be behind the scenes, I'm really this way. So it's still to this day affecting because they still know this old person, and I'm trying to show them that I'm this new person that's really changed, and a lot of them see it. We just have to build up trust, you know, and I just have to keep persevering through it. You know, and just allow the process to keep going through. But I know it's going to take time to heal some wounds, and that's where I'm at with it.
What were you trying to escape from using drugs?
I can't tell you that. I think reality. I think I fabricated this world inside of my mind of a person that's always had money, always partying, always have everybody around. And I have a big family. I have four sisters, three brothers, a whole bunch of aunties, uncles, cousins, but I will always want more people around. Like like I was missing something. And the whole time I had everything, I just always wanted more. I got infatuated with the street life of, okay, this is the way I want to live, because for so long I've been living this church life of, you know, walking the right way and not doing this. So it made me want to try something new since they kept me so isolated. Now, they always gave me freedom, but in a way I felt isolated. So once I got the chance to be free, I just grew accustomed to wanting to do that. And it was fun. Sometimes I would take myself down these long, stupid, retarded roads that wasn't even worth it.
Such as?
I robbed my little brother's family. That's actually what I'm in here for right now. For $100,000, cash money. And that plays a real big part inside my life right now, because I have a whole bunch of family members. Like, what is really going on inside of your mind? And that night I was high on wet, ecstasy pills, and just made a stupid decision, man. You know, I'm not really going to blame it on the drugs. And it was just a retarded decision. Just something at that state of mindset that I'm going to do this. And it backfired on me, majorly backfired on me. Not only did I lose years of my life behind it, but I lost family members behind that too, you know. Through God, now the family's starting to come back around, but man, just the whole process of going through it and knowing that, okay, I'm in here right now, and people see that, okay, he's changing. But when I get out there, that's the real battle, you know, so it's tough.
How has your family seen the changes you have made in your life?
Well, I'm doing a lot in this community. You know, I'm stepping out, really taking my faith serious with God, trying to really trust him and walk with him. And they hear about this. Oh, you're doing this? You're doing this? Wow. You know, I got my GED, joined a program called Toastmasters to speak in front of crowds. And the program by itself, BIBR, has taught me a lot. You know, it's bringing the real man out of me and who the person I really am. And they see it, you know, more of me just telling them I'm doing this. Now they're starting to see it. They're really starting to see it now, just in my character change period, the way I talk, the maturity level I'm at. And that's something I've been praying about, hoping that they do see.
What are some of your favorite BIBR classes?
Authentic manhood, thinking for a change.
What was it about authentic manhood that really impacted you?
Well, it brings out some wounds that you really don't think about from the past, like mother wounds, father wounds, the lack of the father not being inside the house, the lack of the mother not showing the attention that you really need to have, and that stuff you really don't think about. It's teaching how to process through this stuff and break through it, you know? And it's a nice program.
What are some of the wounds you have been healed by your being in this program?
Me and my father, he used to be an alcoholic. He's a pastor over a church now, owns his own business. But before he got saved, he was an alcoholic. And my father used to beat me. You know, I remember he beat me so bad one time that he blacked my eyes, cut my hair. My hair was long, cut it with a knife. My father had spit on me before, hit me with bamboo sticks, and I done been through it. And going through this program has allowed me to really choose to forgive him. This whole time, I've been fighting this, but I really feel peace inside my heart. And I had to get closer inside that area, because he's a wonderful father now. He's a wonderful father. He's my best friend. He's everything to me. And I knew that if I keep holding on to this, that our relationship couldn't go higher than what it should be, to a different level. So where I'm at in my life right now and where he's at in his life right now, I didn't just talk to him as a father and son. I talked to him as a friend, as a son and father too. And man, we just met on a level that we never met on before. And I can sit back and I can process stuff he tells me. And now he's just not making me do it. He's telling me something that I can accept and try to work on. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful. You know, I can sit today and tell you, man, I feel good. You know, I really do feel good. I've never had that happen out of my whole 25 years of living. So it's beautiful.
What's your relationship like with Jesus?
my relationship with Jesus is probably the best thing that I ever did in my whole life, period. I remember when I first started off, I was kind of on the teeter-totter, because I really was like, okay, I really want to do this, but if I sacrifice and really follow Jesus, I got to let all this go. And I never knew how much fun I can actually have with Christ, because I'm young. I still want to do things that I think you can't do it when you have a certain agenda and character that you follow when you're walking with Christ, and it surpasses all our thinking, because here I am walking with him, and I don't do none of the things I used to do, but I carry myself the same way, just in a more mature way. I don't compromise with it. I move freely. You know, I minister to people, I share with them, and some people have turned their life around just off my testimony and stuff that I share with them. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful. This is the most peace I've ever felt in my life. The most freedom. And you would think, since I'm behind bars, that I would feel depressed, angry, bitterness, and I don't feel none of that. It's a high that surpasses every high I've ever had. And I put them first. I put them before my family, and I'm still learning. I'm not perfect. I'm not going to sit here and lie. I still have my flaws. I have my bad days, but I have more good days than bad days. And now he protects me, and he teaches me how to walk down the road and show me stuff in life that I've never seen before. Open up doors for me. I didn't even know I was going to be serving Jesus in my mind. I thought that maybe when I turn 50 years old and don't have nothing else to do, then I'll give my life to Christ. But it's one of the best choices I made. It is the best choice I made, to be honest.
If this program did not exist, what would you have done with your time in prison?
The program brought more out of me. It sharpens me. It sharpens me a lot. The relationships I've been building in here, the people I've been talking to and actually gaining from them, has actually made me mature even more. I don't think if I would have came to the program, it would have took me longer to get where I'm at. That's what I honestly think.
What's your feelings on the mentors and volunteers that come into VIBO?
They're inspiration, man. You know, I don't know anybody really, you know, when you're out on the outside, you think that, you know, you got this mindset about prisoners, but these people that come in actually take their time out of their own day, out of their own free time, and actually come in here to spend time with us and pour out their heart to us. So it motivates me that if they care about me that much, that they're not family, they're not a friend, and they're actually really caring for me, then I should be able to do better. So it encouraged me to even press even harder, to want to bring it more out of me, that I know I can do better, and maybe one day I can do what they do, give back. You know, I think I speak for everybody in this community that we all appreciate it, you know, because I don't know anybody that really take out their free time to come somewhere to where most of society thinks that none of us is going to make it anyway. That's exactly where I'm at with it. That's why I appreciate the volunteers.
This program does the work of changing men's lives, impacting the individual member in his thinking, his behavior, and in his quality of life. We reach men while they are still incarcerated. By this, his family is positively affected by his life change when he returns home from prison. His community is affected, and our state as well. It's called the butterfly effect. The phenomenon whereby a minute change in one part of the world can have large impacting changes elsewhere. So what's the connection to you? Brothers in Blue Reentry. Because what happens in prison matters. It matters that change must happen. And we need your help to ensure that it does. Thank you for listening to Real Voices. Please tune in next week.